Är den på? Hallå, god morgon. God morgon. Jag är nästan benägen att säga en gång till god morgon för att se om ni verkligen är vaken. God morgon. Ja. Välkommen till 11:e gången av internetdagarna. Det finns en hel del länder som börjar med det som de kallar IGF-dagar. Och vi har haft redan 11 sådana i rad. Jag började i morse med pressfrukost och berättade att det var roligt att, och nyttigt att tänka tillbaka hur det var för ett år sedan. Och för ett år sedan när vi stod här så hade vi väldigt mycket kring FRA. Lagen hade precis kommit igång och vi har haft en jättemycket debatt kring FRA. Och vi hade precis haft Pirate Bay-domen. Vi hade James Boyle här förra året, för de som kom ihåg. Det är väldigt mycket upphovsrättsfrågor. Och vi hade en liten överraskning att Åsa Torstensson kom förbi och berättade om regeringens nya bredbandsstrategi. Jag försöker tänka lite vad som har skett i år. Och det som har fastnat hos mig väldigt mycket är att man har börjat snacka väldigt mycket om hot på internet. Cybersecurity. Amerika har en cybersecurity-tsar, vad det nu är. Man börjar prata om att man inte ska ha en Air Force och inte bara ha Marines, men man ska också ha någon form av extra mankraft för att motverka en cybersecurity-war, eller vinna den. Vi hade en ny vd på ICANN som började skrämma alla regeringar och säga att DNS skulle fallera. Vi har haft väldigt mycket diskussion kring internet governance, styrning av internet. Vem får bestämma, vem kan bestämma, vem vill bestämma. Och det har väldigt mycket att göra med att regeringen har fått ögonen upp på internet. Vill jättegärna på något sätt har en möjlighet att kontrollera vad som händer i mina ögon. Så det är väldigt spännande att följa den debatten. Jag vet att vissa av er har varit precis i Mexiko och har deltagit där. Vi har haft människor i Vilnius. Det finns ett möte väldigt snart i Colombia. Så det är väldigt mycket som sker där. Det finns väldigt mycket diskussion kring nätneutralitet. Det finns en EU-enkät som har precis har blivit besvarat, tror jag. Och där finns diskussionen, har vi ett problem med nätneutralitet? Har vi samma problem som i Amerika? Eller har vi överhuvudtaget inga problem? De bitarna som kommer säkert tillbaka i år på internetdagarna. Det glädjer mig att vi kommer att ha besök av vår nya IT-minister imorgon. Se om vi kommer att se någon ändring i strategi, om det blir mer bredband eller om det blir någonting annat. Någonting annat skulle i så fall vara det som vi själva på .se tycker är väldigt viktigt. Det är digital delaktighet. Att inte bara prata om kablar eller hastigheter men också prata om kunskap. Och att försöka få dem som inte använder internet att börja använda internet. Vi har kommit långt med internet i Sverige. Man brukar, tycker jag, som holländare kanske, jag tycker att man gnäller lite mycket här, men jag tycker att Sverige ser jättefint ut. Det finns en rapport, Svenskarna och internet, som visar att vi i Sverige ligger topp ett. Eller på första plats på 3 olika index, och så läs gärna rapporten och bli lite stolt också. Det betyder att vi inte har så mycket problem, men vi har väldigt många möjligheter kvar att bli ännu bättre. Så att de aldrig kommer ikapp oss. Och det är också det som vi kan diskutera här på internetdagar. Vi börjar den här delen med Jeff Cole. Vi har 3 keynote speakers. Vi har Jeff Cole, vi har Danny McPherson och vi har Jonas Birgersson. Och låt oss börja med Jeff. Jeff jobbar på Annenberg School Center for Digital Future. Am I right?
You are completely
okay.
Right.
Jeff, if you come to the speaker table and...
Great. Oh, thank you. I didn't actually realize I was on. Thank you very much. I am delighted to be here. I love Sweden. I will come for anything. This is actually the third time I've been at Internet Days. I am honored to be here. I have a lot to say. They've only given me till 12:15 to finish my talk. So let's get started. I'm somebody who really believes we lost a great opportunity with television. Television, the most powerful medium ever invented, and I was always taught that what we should have done but didn't do is we should have tracked people before they had television and gone back to them year after year to see how it changed their lives. And I became convinced in the late 90s that the impact of digital, first the web and now mobile, was going to be far more powerful than television. So believing that we lost a great opportunity, 10 years ago, we launched this massive project, this tracking of the web that we thought should have been conducted of television in the 40s. We started in the US, and now we're working in 35 countries around the world. I'm delighted to say that one of our first and our best partners is Sweden, and Olof Findahl is going to talk a little bit about some of the work we've done together. So what I wanted to do this morning was I really wanted to look back over 10 years and look at some of the profound changes we've seen. And first I want to show how it looks at first glance as if everything is falling apart, disaggregating, coming into little pieces, making no sense. And then I want to show you my vision as to how it all comes together. So let's start with falling apart, with the fact that navigating through this media world used to be easy, predictable, consistent. If you worked in the television business, the newspaper business, the advertising business, and you went into any of those businesses in 1950, and you retired in 1995, you would have had a fascinating career. But those businesses were fundamentally the same in 1995 as they were in 1950. If you were in the television business over those 45 years, we added color, we added more channels with cable and satellite, but it was fundamentally the same business. In the newspaper business, we also added color, different distribution systems, but it was still the same business. If you went into any of those industries 5 years ago, you wouldn't recognize them today. Everything is changing, and at first glance, it looks like everything is falling apart. We see schedules have almost disappeared. In the newspaper business, people won't live by a newspaper schedule anymore. If you're standing on your doorstep, the moment the newspaper arrives, it's already 6 hours out of date. If you read a story and you want an update, you have to wait 24 hours. That just doesn't work for anyone anymore. In the music industry had one of the most formalized schedules of any medium. A group, an artist, would get together, generally record 12 songs or about 38 to 40 minutes worth of music. If they were a progressive group, it might be 5 or 6 songs. Even when CDs came along and allowed albums to be not 40 minutes but 72 minutes, they still recorded about 38 to 40 minutes. They would release a song, put it on the radio, hopefully it would be successful. 6 or 8 weeks later, a second song would go onto the radio, and if it was a really good album, a third song would go on. And then 6 months into the release, the group or the artist would go on tour, and 24 months later, the whole cycle would repeat. Well, from the beginning, that didn't work for some people. Prince, the artist Prince, was constantly at war with his record label, Warner Brothers, because Prince, unlike most mortal human beings, could actually release about 12 albums a year worth of material. But his label, Warner, didn't want that. The system couldn't accommodate that. It would have flooded it. You wouldn't have been able to distinguish songs. And he was constantly fighting and eventually left his label in disgust. Today, Prince releases all of that music. And according to my friends, most of it is pretty good. And now we're waiting to see what's the new schedule for music. Will groups still put together 40 minutes worth of music and release it at once? Will they release 2 songs every few months, 1 song at a time? We're waiting to see what the new schedule will be. And television was on such a schedule that the most successful magazine in the history of publishing, TV Guide, came from simply listing what was on television. Sort of depressing if you think about it. Now, TV Guide, one of the few bad business decisions Rupert Murdoch ever made, he paid $3 billion for TV Guide in 1990 and sold it last year for less than the price of one issue on the newsstand, for less than $2, plus the assumption of debt. And the reason TV Guide doesn't work anymore? Because if you talk to a teenager about the days you used to watch television when a broadcast network told you you had to watch television, you're going to sound to them the way our great-great-grandparents would have sounded to us talking about horses and buggies. Schedules don't work. We know there's too much choice. In America, where most markets had 7 television stations in 1975, 90% of viewing was on 3 stations. 30 years later, when most markets had over 100 channels, 90% of viewing was on 6 channels. You give people infinite more choice, and we only venture out a little bit. People who run restaurants know this. They know that most of us don't want 20-page menus in restaurants. That frustrates us. We have too many choices. We always feel unsatisfied because we could have ordered something else. Restaurant owners know that most of us want 8 to 10 choices in a restaurant. Enough choices to feel that we can actually make a choice, but not enough to be overwhelmed. And on the internet, where we actually have tens of millions of choices, but let's be practical, for most of us, we have thousands of choices. For where we have thousands of choices, we know that 90% of internet time is spent on 15 sites. Now, that's not the same 15 sites for you as it is for me, but each of us spends about 90% of our time in 15 places because we're overwhelmed by choice. We know, and those of you who have heard me speak before, I've been talking about this for a long time, and it seems to be coming more true. We know that all media survive. No media are going away, but most media survive as smaller players in a digital era. I talked the last time I was here about theatrical film and the fact that in 1946 in North America, we sold 4.3 billion movie tickets. Last year, in order to keep pace, because the population had more than doubled, we would have had to sell about 9 billion movie tickets. Instead, we sold 1.4 billion. Or put another way, 1946, 90 million people a week went to the movies. Last year, population more than doubled, 22 million people a week went to the movies. Theatrical film has learned how to survive as a small player, but a high profile, highly profitable business drives the home video business. The music business, we know, has had an historic business model that is nothing short of extortion. The business model of the music industry has always said, you like 2 songs? You have to spend $16 on a CD. Today, interest in music has never been greater. People are listening to more music in more places, but they're not going to the music store. In most cities, including Stockholm, I can't even find a music store anymore. And the depressing future of the music business is if they get it right, if they figure out how to get you and your children to go online and buy their music, and that's a big if they can do that, what used to produce $16 in the past today will produce $2, and that's if they get it right. And in the newspaper business, we know that in every country in the world we are in, when internet penetration gets to 30%, offline newspaper sales begin to decline. Even here in Sweden, the heaviest newspaper reading society on the face of the earth per capita. I don't say that to be kind. You really are an amazing group of newspaper readers, unlike us in America. 10 years ago, we could see that every time a newspaper reader died, he or she wasn't being replaced by a new reader. 10 years ago, I went to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, who last year renamed themselves the American Society of News Editors. I went to the ASNE 10 years ago, and I told them, every time one of your readers dies, they're not being replaced. And then I looked at them and I said, you have 25 to 30 years left. Figure it out. They called me dangerous. They called me an alarmist. They called me everything except what it turns out I actually was, which was not correct. I was an optimist. Because if I was right 10 years ago that they had 25 to 30 years left, today they should have 15 to 20. In America, they have less than 5. In the UK, 7 or 8. Australia, 9. We'll see what's left in Sweden. So all of these media survive, but we think most of them survive as smaller players. Continuing showing how everything is falling apart, we think most of today's platforms will change. The DVD and the CD are down to their last 5 years, not movies and music, just the platforms, which are considered environmentally wasteful. We've already seen the packaging for CDs shrink. Then we're going to see the CD itself disappear. And the concept of owning music, you know this with Spotify, the concept of owning music or the concept of owning movies will become a quaint old notion. Instead of owning anything, we'll have access to everything. And one of the things accelerating the demise of the newspaper is environmental concerns. An American example for scale, the New York Times at its peak 5 years ago used to print 200 million pieces of paper a day, except on Sunday when it printed 2 billion pieces of paper and then hired thousands of trucks using gasoline spewing carbon into the air. Today, children turn to their parents saying, how can you read the newspaper? Don't you care about the future of the earth? You're all getting emails. Some of you are sending emails at the bottom of which it will say, please be kind to the earth and don't print this out. We know that consumers are beginning to abandon subscriptions to traditional print media. Our work shows in developed countries, 60% of internet users have abandoned a print subscription to get the same content for free on the web. Publishers, and we'll talk about this at the very end, are now looking for ways to monetize and get people to pay. But we know there's not a tradition of paying. We know that for the first 5 years of the internet, users felt that all the content on the web should be free the way the good Lord intended it to be. And it's been very hard to come in later and to get people to pay, particularly for what they've already gotten for free, which our work shows Twitter is going to have a very difficult time if they ever try to get people to pay for the service. And it's also difficult to get people to pay for content they can get elsewhere for free. But we'll see some of the lessons there. We know that traditional media has had problems with its advertising, which has been the basis of most of its support because of engagement. We know that long before the internet came along, when a television commercial came on, most of the audience went to the kitchen, went to the bathroom, changed the channel, muted the set, scanned through the commercial, and advertisers were tired of paying for the whole audience that watched the show when they know that the majority of that audience wasn't there when the commercial came on. There wasn't engagement. And we know the rules of digital advertising are much more complex and different than the rules of traditional advertising. You run an ad on television that people don't like, and they don't pay attention to it, or they ignore it. You do something in a digital environment that offends people, like a pop-up ad, and they will share it with each other, they will lobby you, they will hunt you down and kill you, not quite, but close. It's a very different set of rules. So on first look, it appears everything is falling apart, making no sense, the old rules are broken, and where do we go from here? But the thing that has really changed everything is broadband. You can't overestimate the importance of broadband. I actually believe there's a bigger gap between dial-up and broadband than non-use and dial-up. Broadband changed everything, not because of the speed, but it's the always-on, the direct connection that changed the entire relationship to the internet. In the dial-up era, we saw the average dial-up user went online 2 or 3 times a day, 20 to 30 minutes at a time, in these buckets of minutes. We aggregated or combined all of our tasks because we viewed dialing up as a big deal. We'd write down in the back of an envelope all the things we wanted to do when we logged on. And if we logged off forgetting to do those things, we'd get irritated at ourselves. And one of the things we saw was with dial-up, since people were going on in these buckets of 20 or 30 minutes, they wanted time that they weren't disturbed. Where they had a choice, they would move the internet into the backstage of the home, if their home had a backstage, into the back bedroom, the office, someplace where they wouldn't be disturbed. And it was 20 or 30 minutes spent not talking to the family, although the family could wander back and talk to them. And it was 20 or 30 minutes spent not watching television, although many people had a television set in the backstage of their home, and we did multitask from the beginning. But then broadband comes along, and we're on not 2 or 3 times a day, but 30 to 50 times a day, not for 20 or 30 minutes, but 2 or 3 minutes, in these pockets of minutes rather than buckets of minutes. And we didn't have to aggregate or combine all of our tasks with broadband because we could do one or two things. And then if we remembered a third a minute later, it didn't bother us. We just went back since it was always on and did that. Well, since we were going on 30 to 50 times a day, we didn't want the internet in the backstage of the home. We didn't want to walk into the back bedroom 50 times a day. We wanted it where we were, and we brought it into the center stage of the home, into the family room, the den, and the most humanly networked room in the house, which most of you, I'm sure, know, the kitchen. The kitchen, the first room in which people stop when they enter the home, the room in which most women leave their purses. If you're going to leave a message for another member of the household, we almost always do so in the kitchen. The kitchen also contains the family art gallery, also known as the refrigerator. So people were moving the internet to where they were. And all of a sudden, it wasn't on broadband, it wasn't displacing family conversation. It was occurring during the natural rhythms and pauses of family conversation. And in the center stage of the home, the internet on broadband wasn't displacing television programming viewing. We were going on before the program started, after it ended, or in some cases, even more worrisome for the broadcaster, it became one more thing we did during the commercial. But it's turned out that broadband is the best friend television's ever had, because television couldn't grow until broadband. Television already dominated our at-home awake time. Most of us turn the television set on the moment we enter the home, leave it on till we go to sleep. Some of us go to sleep with it on, and some of us leave it on when we're not at home so that people think we are at home. But now through broadband, television's escaped from the home. We watch it at the airport on our mobile phones, on the airplane, in the back seat of our cars, hopefully not the front seat while we're driving. And all of a sudden, not just with television, but through broadband, we see a vision of all these things coming together. Social networks, a key part of that. And social networking, we believe, is the real deal. The first thing that has caused people to log onto the web more than to check their email. We think which social network a teenager is in is a trend or fad, but that social networking is permanent, and the heaviest users of social networks are people in their 60s and 70s and the people who derive the most value. But we do think for a teen, a social network is a trend. 5 years ago, when Rupert Murdoch bought MySpace for $580 million, he was saying that he bought it because that was the best way to reach teenagers. You can't reach teenagers through television as well anymore. So he bought it to reach teenagers. About 2 weeks later, we released our fifth report. I was talking to reporters, and they were asking all kinds of questions about what we were finding. And then the last question was, what do you think about Murdoch buying MySpace? And I said, I think it's a great investment. That part of the quote got lost forever. But he'll never be able to hang on to the teenage users of MySpace. They got very angry about that, and they fought back, not by saying we were wrong, we will be able to hang on to them, but instead by saying, look how much money we've made. They were absolutely right. They signed a $900 million ad share deal with Google almost from the day they bought MySpace. It looks like a phenomenal deal, particularly when you consider 2 years ago, AOL spent $850 million to buy Bebo and sold it over the summer for $5 million 2 years later. So they were right, but it turns out we were right as well. They weren't able to hang on to the teenage users of MySpace. We got a lot of attention 5 years ago when we talked about the fact that to a teenager, an online community is like a nightclub. And when the nightclub becomes too popular or the uncool kids show up, they're out of there. And as a teenager, what's the worst thing that could happen to you in a nightclub? Not literally the worst thing. That would be a gunman or a bomber coming in. But the worst thing for most teenagers in a nightclub? Running into your mother. Well, now on Facebook, your mother wants to friend you. How long are you going to stay in a place where your mother's hanging around? So we've watched GeoCities morph into Friendster into MySpace, MySpace into Facebook. I was in Brazil last week where Orkut has been a way of life. That's now morphing into Facebook. And we think Facebook will morph as well, although we've never seen anything get to 500 million people. We think it'll take longer, and we don't think Facebook will be replaced by one big community, but by smaller communities. And of course, many people still have their MySpace membership. They just don't use it. We don't think people will literally leave Facebook. It will just recede. But social networking, we think, brings everything together. We think in a broadband world, newspapers can compete in a way they never could before. My favorite cartoon from the 90s showed a dog sitting in front of a computer with the caption, "On the internet, no one knows you're a dog." Well, today, on the internet, no one knows you're a newspaper. Because on the internet, the newspaper, which isn't paper anymore, is live, is 24/7. It's not 6 hours out of date when it gets to you. It has audio. It has video. On the internet, there's no difference between a newspaper and television. And radio faces this interesting question, and you have one of the best public radio systems in the world. Radio faces the question, as it goes online, does it want to add video and essentially become television? Or does it consider the lack of video, audio only, to be part of its unique DNA? Is the lack of video a liability they'll correct as soon as they can? Or is radio only audio? And I think in Sweden, radio will stay only audio, but we will see. We expect to see consolidation, unlike any consolidation we've ever seen before. In 1900 in America, we had 600 communities that had two or more newspapers. Today we have four. Instead of counting down the two newspaper towns, we're now counting up the no newspaper towns. And I predict that our 1,000 newspapers will be down to four in the next 8 or 9 years. But those four, I think it'll be the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, maybe USA Today, will become global voices. The New York Times, already through the International Herald, wants to be the global edition. I think there will be at least one global Swedish voice. I mentioned I was in Brazil, where Globo will become, I think, the global Brazilian voice. But I think we're going to see incredible consolidation, not just with newspapers. In North America, we have 600 jazz radio stations. Based on the way our broadcasting is set up, you have to listen to whatever jazz station, good or bad, is in your community. In the future, we will listen to the best jazz station in the world, which my friends tell me is actually in India. We're not going to have hundreds. We're probably going to have 4 or 5 great jazz stations where location is irrelevant. Even in education, we know in the U.S. 2,000 professors teach introduction to psychology. Let's be charitable and say 20% teach it well, 20% teach it poorly, and 60% teach it adequately. Why should anyone have to take that class from anyone except the best professor in the world who might be dead when they actually take the class? And I think in the future, as students go to college, they're going to take 2 or 3 big classes that are the same whether they're in Sweden or the U.S. or Japan, like Introduction to Psychology. They'll take 2 or 3 of those classes online, and then when they get to college in person, they will take smaller classes and specialized classes from experts. We think consolidation will affect everything, and for the consumer, in a positive way. We know there are only 3 ways to acquire content. You can steal it, and even those who steal it acknowledge that's not a very good business model. You can pay fees or subscriptions, or you can accept advertising. Our work shows, with some exceptions, consumers clearly prefer advertising. We will pay for some content. Murdoch gets people to pay for the Wall Street Journal because they perceive that financial information is unique and not available anywhere else. But he also tried to get his readers of the London Times to start paying. And that information, generic news, is available anywhere. And once they had to pay, traffic to the website went down by more than 80%. We think people will pay for value for information they believe to be unique. We also think brand is more important in a digital world than it's ever been before. Brand connotes familiarity and reliability, and now we are so overwhelmed with information and things that we need shortcuts. We're seeing teenagers in the U.S. who've never read the New York Times going to the newyorktimes.com because it's shorthand for quality and reliability. Brand, the things that stand out, become much more important when you have access to millions of things rather than dozens or hundreds of things. We think the solution to paying, this is my view, I'm not a shill for the advertising business. I believe if digital content is going to survive, it's going to be largely through advertising. I want to see digital content survive, so I want to see advertising survive. I think it comes through addressability, the ability of advertisers to know who they're advertising to. This has benefits to media owners because cost per thousand can go up as much as 10 times when the advertiser only has to pay for people who have been screened. This has the advantage to the advertiser themselves because most of you know the most famous quote in the history of advertising, so famous it's a cliche. You may not know that it came from John Wanamaker of Wanamaker's department store, but the quote was, Wanamaker said, "I know that half my advertising budget is wasted. I just don't know which half." In truth, it's more like 80%. Now the advertiser only spends money on people he or she actually want to reach. And it has advantages to the consumer because they can receive advertising that is engaging and relevant to them. The concern is privacy, a very important concern, and I think those concerns can be dealt with 4 simple but clear steps. 1, the advertiser, the newspaper, the television station has to explain what information they're collecting and why. 2, there have to be privacy statements not written by lawyers for lawyers. 3, there have to be stiff penalties for anyone who violate those policies. And 4, there has to be a clear and easy opt-out, although people who opt out might have to start paying for the same content other people get for free. I think it's incumbent on everyone that their learning curve has to be much steeper than their action curve. We have to be studying, tracking, paying attention to everything. We don't have to be doing everything. 3 years ago, I was telling every brand, every person I could talk to, learn everything you can learn about Second Life. I wasn't telling them that they had to go into Second Life or buy an island. I remember I was here 3 years ago when the Swedish government opened a consulate in Second Life. Just that people had to study it. Now my message to companies and brands, if you're in Second Life, get the hell out as fast as you possibly can. Second Life has turned really slimy. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal about 6 months ago about a woman saying, my husband's in Second Life. He has a wife in Second Life. They have sex. They go shopping. She seemed much more irritated that they went shopping than that they had sex. And then she admitted, he's a good husband. He's never met this woman. They don't talk on the phone. And then she asked, do I have a problem? I think the answer is yes. Now I think we're past the point where you just have to be looking at social networking. You have to actually understand it. I think the same is true with Twitter. Location-based, these are things, Foursquare, these are things people really have to understand. And then finally, for people who ask about Web 3.0, I'm not being disingenuous when I'm saying I don't even know what Web 2.0 is. But I do know we get to the next level or we get to where we're going when we never talk about broadband speeds ever again. You're close to that in Sweden. When broadband becomes like electricity, it's just there. You don't walk into your home, flip the switch, and say, gosh, I hope there's enough power in the walls to run all my appliances. It's just there, and you don't notice it till there's a blackout. Then you notice that you can't do anything. And when we can get anything we want, when we want it, on our schedule, the way we want it, with advertising without, and when we're in control, we've gotten to the next level. That's a little bit of our view. Anyone who's interested in our work, welcome to go to our website or send me a note, and I'm going to be around for the next 2 days. And as always, and I mean this as sincerely as I can, it is wonderful to be in Sweden, and I appreciate all of this, and I look forward to the next presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. A bit like a broadband Jesus also. Next speaker is Danny McPherson from VeriSign. He will take us from the services and the application to the lower levels of internet infrastructure. There's a risk that this will be a crash course in high-speed internet talking, as he warned that he speaks very fast, so keep track of your audience and see if you're losing them. Thank you.
All right, yeah, thank you. All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to be here, actually. I was trying to find ways that I could bridge what Jeff was saying with what I'm saying, and, you know, I came up with a few, actually. I'm going to talk a little bit about some trends in consolidation of content and, you know, the internet infrastructure, and you know, with regards to social networks, I previously worked at infrastructure security company, and a lot of stuff like tracking botnets and malware and helping people mitigate attacks. And my daughters would ask me how, you know, what I did and what it was I actually worked on. And like, all right, whatever, Dad. And so now I just recently moved to VeriSign about 5 months ago, and we operate some of the registries and .com and .net and so forth. So my daughters were asking me what I was going to be doing there, and I said, well, a lot of the same stuff and some new things, but we actually operate these internet registries. Like, well, that's cool. You know what? You know, she basically didn't care much about it. I was like, well, we make, you know, all these online social networks like Facebook.com and Twitter.com. Those things wouldn't work if our infrastructure didn't work. And she said, well, it's like, yeah, that really doesn't mean anything to me, Dad. So she didn't care, right? She didn't care. And it actually has a lot to do with what I'm going to talk about today, is a lot of the things that enable the infrastructure, things like the domain name system and a .se and what that actually entails. How that, you know, these sort of, you know, the veiled risks associated with those. People don't sort of enumerate or think about the, you know, what enables them to access the content that they actually desire. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I actually have a longer session this afternoon in Attack Vectors where I'm going to talk about a lot of stuff related to infrastructure security and security trends as well. So anyway, that said, we'll jump right into this. So I'm going to share a couple of primitives of the internet architecture first, and then we'll step into some changes that are occurring with those and why those might be challenging. So, you know, if you sort of step back, the internet's, you know, a collection of loosely interconnected networks, right? Of global loosely interconnected networks, and you know, there's no single authority, there's no single, you know, single point of control on this network. It's datagram or packet based, and what we mean by that is that information's chopped up into little pieces, and it's sent out into the network to find its way to the destination. And each piece of data, each one of these datagrams, has destination information on it. So you could liken it to an envelope on a letter. And they put the envelope on there, and they say this is destination, and they put it in the system, and it somehow magically finds its way to the other side, to the destination, right? And there are some things that enables. And then, one of the ultimate goals in designing packet or datagram-based networks initially when they were being researched was end-to-end, any-to-any connectivity, meaning I put something in an envelope and I send it off to the destination, and the destination gets it, and nobody in the middle needed to look at the contents of that or to understand the contents. And so there's this sort of layered model actually provides some scalability. The network's dumb and the edges are smart, and it enables innovation. And so that's some of these sorts of things is what has actually allowed IP and the internet to be so successful today. So some really high level bits, if you think about, you know, some of the primary infrastructure elements, you ask me as sort of a routing and network and security guy, I think about DNS and routing and IP and so forth. And, a name is, you know, where do you want to go? What's your sort of navigation anchor, if you will? And then the address is where it is on the infrastructure. You know, what's it mapped to? What, you know, where am I actually going? And then the route is how to get there. And so, you know, the DNS and the IP namespace and the addressing infrastructure is extremely important. And then BGP or the Internet Routing System is how you reach a given destination on the internet. Some of the primitives this enables are, you get these sort of systemic threats because of the way the infrastructure works. There are some, you know, the IP network itself is very resilient, and you get this end-to-end, any-to-any connectivity with lots of resiliency. But at the same time, there are these hierarchical overlay systems. So, for example, DNS is one such example, I guess, is that while I could reach someone in the same state or the same country, I may not be able to reach them unless I resolve a DNS query on a network somewhere else in the world. And so DNS and these infrastructure enabling protocols must function before I can get that user desired content, and that's really important. Asymmetry of threats, I'll talk about a little more in just a moment, and then the complexity and attribution. From a security perspective, one of the challenges with the internet is anybody has sort of global reach or global projection capability. And so, you know, when you think about everything from cybercrime to cyberbullying to cyberterrorism, you know, the full spectrum, attribution is really, really difficult to see who launched an attack or who was responsible for, you know, some malicious activity, or see if someone's credentials were compromised. Was it really the person that said they did that? So anyway, you know, when you ask most people about the internet, if you ask my daughter or you know, your average internet user, the internet looks a lot like this, right? It's you sort of got a disk drive on the other side of their broadband connection, and they think that all the content they want to access is on that big disk drive, and there aren't any variables, right? But you know, the reality is that a lot of the content you get isn't local to you. It may even be global on someone else's network. But again, before you can access that content, you have to go, you know, resolve, for example, DNS transactions or certificate status queries or that sort of thing, maybe on 10 or 15 or 20 different networks before you can actually get the content that you want. And if those infrastructure enabling or supporting transactions don't resolve correctly, then you can't get the content you want. So it's really critical that infrastructure be available on the back end. So the internet protocol model, what's it look like? This is what I was talking about a moment ago. And this is sort of the layered architecture of the internet, right? What you see on the two sides is you got a user, in this case an application that's a web browser, could be an email client, could be anything. On the far side, you got a web server, an email server, something like that. And you have this layered network architecture. So it's end-to-end, any-to-any. And when I say end-to-end, IP sort of sets at layer three, or what we call the network layer. And every device from the end systems, from this laptop to the wireless access point, to the router, to the intermediate devices, to the server on the other side, have to support IP at the network layer, right? or IPv4 in this case, and we're going to talk about just for a moment about IPv6 in a bit. And then at the layer below that, you have things like radio and fiber and Ethernet and 3G and so forth that are providing what you call the link layer and the physical layer substrate. And then above it, you have the applications. The applications are are sort of what benefits most from the network externality or the network effect, right? So you got user groups on the internet that drive things and enable, you know, social networks and so forth. The challenge at the network layer is that most people don't see that. It just enables the infrastructure and the connectivity. So that's sort of the layered model. What this allows you to do is those intermediate devices in the network don't have to be as sophisticated. If you thought about sort of the postal system again, and you sent that envelope, and you put your letter in there, and you sealed it, and you put the destination address on it, and sent it out in the network. If you assume that the Postal Service had to open that envelope and read the contents of that to decide where it should go or how it should be processed in the system, it obviously wouldn't scale very well. And so that's sort of what you're looking at here, is those intermediate devices in the network don't look at the payload or the contents of the infrastructure generally. And so that allows you to get end-to-end and preserves privacy and other functions. What I'm going to talk about here. So one of the other points that I'm going to talk about some is that because this is end-to-end, each device on the network requires a unique identifier, an IP address. Today it's IPv4, and IPv4 traditionally provided about 4 billion IP addresses, 4 million unique identifiers on the network. Well, given that there are 7 billion people in the world, and some folks project that in 2 to 4 years that a single individual may have 16 IP addresses themselves, or 16 different devices that have IP addresses. That's obviously a challenge. So we're actually, the IPv4 address space is quickly depleting, and within the next year, at the root of this allocation hierarchy for IPv4, will be fully depleted. And so IPv6 is sort of the next set of address space there, and it has 340 trillion addresses, and so it should be a bit more sufficient at the end of the day. So. All right, so I'm going to share a couple of stats. If you look at textbooks, or anyone taking a computer science network engineering course, the old internet looked like the one on the left, where you had a very hierarchical structure and a couple of folks at the top. But the reality is that today it looks a lot more like the one on the right. The internet's much, much flatter. To illustrate this, it's grown over an order of magnitude in the last 10 years from the number of participating networks, that loosely interconnected set of networks that make up the internet. But the diameter from one AS to, from one network or routing domain to any other one on the internet has actually shrunk over time. And so, that the result of that's because networks are much more densely interconnected. And so that has lots of effects, right? I mean, that provides robustness in the infrastructure. It helps that IP resiliency, the end-to-end model, if the transactions and what you're actually looking for are as equally resilient. But when you look at content consolidation, back to some of Jeff's point, what you actually see over the last few years is a significant consolidation of content. What you're looking at here, this is called a CDF, or cumulative distribution format graph. And basically, the takeaway here is that in 2007, about 1,500 AS's made up for 50% of the content on the internet. And in 2009, it's only 150. About 30 networks on the internet account for about 30% of all internet traffic. And to see how that's evolved, you see Google and Comcast there. Actually, I was reading a blog post from some of my ex-colleagues at Arbor yesterday, or this morning, I think. And, Google is actually number two now with about 6 or 7% steady state of all internet traffic, one organization, right? So that has some significant implications on everything from privacy to user tracking to policy and regulatory issues. What else do we want to say? So I guess when you have this, the fabric of the network is much more densely interconnected, but content, what people want to access, is much more consolidated, then you have these reliability issues that may emerge. If that site's not available, what's that mean to your average user on the internet? Another example, actually, is end-to-end. So we were talking about end-to-end. Traditionally, when IP was designed, if you knew the destination IP address of some place on the internet, you simply put your envelope, you put your letter in your envelope and sent the envelope to into the network, and it found its way to the destination. They opened it, right? Well, you could use any protocol, any language you wanted, do anything you wanted inside the envelope, essentially, right? Well, with security in particular, a lot of folks block everything, for example, but web ports or email ports and so forth. So in order for application developers or people that want to innovate on the internet, instead of just putting it in you know, in a standard IP packet and sending it to some destination on the internet. Now what they do is they say, well, I'm going to put it in the web port because the web port is going to have a hole in a firewall and let me reach the destination more sufficiently. So this bottom right graphic here, there's something known as sort of the IP hourglass model. And basically that IP, that network layer, is the thin waist of the hourglass. And it's starting to look more like what you see in the diagram now, where most of what goes over the internet is actually tunneled in TCP port 80, or, you know, the web port, so that it can find its way through a firewall. And that's not necessarily a good thing. We're losing some of the transparency end-to-end on the internet. Some other things, so IPv4 depletion and IPv6 deployment I was talking about. One of the challenges with this, and why it's important, if you're not looking at IPv6 already and you have anything to do with the network, you should be. The reason it's important is because IPv4 and IPv6 are what you call bits on the wire compatible. So if you have an IPv4 laptop and an IPv6 laptop on the same network, they can't speak natively to each other. They have to have some translation function. And this is a challenge. The deployment model for IPv6 was everybody's going to run IPv4 and IPv6, and then when we get to that state, we'll turn off all the IPv4. And, you know, that was 15, 20 years ago. And today, we don't have enough IPv4 to accommodate what we call a dual-stack deployment model. And so that's a challenging challenging transition plan. But as I noted earlier, that the sort of the top of the hierarchy for address allocation of IPv4 addresses is going to be exhausted within a year. And then the regional registries, in this case, right primarily for Sweden or the European region, is, you know, just subsequent to that. It's within operational time frame, so you definitely need to be looking at IPv6 in your infrastructure. Routing on the internet. Routing on the internet operates in a manner that I call routing by rumor. And basically, if you recall earlier, routing is how you get somewhere on the internet. So I send a packet in the network, and it magically finds its way to the destination, all right? Well, the reality is that this routing protocol, the Border Gateway Protocol, sets up that reachability. And what I do with the Border Gateway Protocol, BGP, is I announce in the internet, I assert reachability for some set of destinations. Well, there's no central authority or no sort of authoritative source that says who holds what number of resources on the internet. And if you don't have that, you can't secure the routing system. But if you have that and you use it to secure the routing system, then that's another dependency that doesn't exist in the system today. So you have to balance those things and figure out, figure out how to best balance autonomy that you may want to gain with the security of the system. Essentially, today in the routing system, pretty much anybody that has access to a BGP-speaking router, an internet router, can assert reachability for anyone else's address space. And we've seen a lot of incidents related to this. And Curtis may actually be talking about some of that later in his talk. Some of the other things, most of your user desired transactions, if you want to go to Facebook, what do? The very first thing your client does is resolve www.facebook.com to an IP address, right? And how does it do that? It uses DNS, the domain name system. And then it reaches out to the local recursive name server, which hopefully is on the same network. Then it reaches, if it's not cached in that server, then it reaches out to a root name server, then to a top-level domain server, and then to a second-level domain server that's probably Facebook.com's, right? Well, those are three different iterations and about, you know, four or five transactions potentially to enable that. And a lot of times those servers don't actually sit on the same network, and they could be multinational. And if any one of those in that sort of resolution chain break, then the user can't get to the content they desire. And so you have to enumerate that and consider that as part of your operational surface or attack surface, if you will. Certificate status, you have to be able to resolve certificate status if you're doing secure transactions. And a lot of times the content you want to access may not be local or within some area that, it's not that disk drive at the end of your broadband connection. It's, some remote place on the internet. Okay, so the DNS landscape, if you ask me what it looked like from a high level right now, I'd say it looks like you got money over here and you got knowledge or truth or integrity on the left side, right? And in between somewhere, it's like, well, which way do we go with this? So everybody's like, hey, we got DNSSEC, and it gives us integrity in DNS. And on the other side, you got people that use, either rogue DNS resolvers if you're a miscreant and want to compromise end users or phish sites, or you want to do botnet if you're an ISP. Maybe you want to do botnet quarantine or walled garden functions, or maybe you want to do NX domain mapping and generate search revenue from your subscribers if you're an ISP, or you want to implement parental controls for your users and so forth. And so, on the other side, that's all about not telling the truth in DNS, right? So DNSSEC's about integrity, and there are things that can bring you, like new applications. with carrying certificates or other data you may want to have in the DNS. But on the far right side, it's like, hey, here's the money, and it doesn't involve integrity. So that's a challenge. So finding ways to balance integrity and the authenticity of data in the DNS with the contrasting desire for capitalist markets, I guess, and operators to make money is challenging and something we're going to continue to struggle with. Reactive control. So I slid this slide in the deck because it's pretty important for people to understand this. Basically, what you're looking at here is this bottom right graph, this triangle, is sort of network layer. That's IP, if you recall the internet layered model. And then up the stack is applications. And basically, the wider the triangle gets there, the more vulnerabilities you see. If you look at the number of vulnerabilities that saw exploits last year, in other words, the piece of malcode on the internet that existed, there's a new piece of malcode every 10 seconds, more or less, right? Literally every 10 seconds. And our number one defense to protect against this is antivirus software, IDSs, right? Well, if there's a new piece of malcode every 10 seconds, and I update my antivirus software, my IDS once a week or once a day or whatever it is, and on average those signatures are 2 weeks old, I'm probably not protected all the time, right? As a matter of fact, if you take the top 10 antivirus engines and you squished them all together and said, you know, what's the result I get for protection, it's about 80 to 90% on average best case, right? And on average, if you just take one, you end up with about 60 to 70% percent protection against the unique threats on the internet. And anybody in here that's a security person realizes you have to be right all the time. The miscreants only have to be right once. So what you're saying is 9 out of every 10 transactions you're reasonably secure on the internet, but 1 out of 10 you're not. And every time you go on the internet, there's, you know, a million transactions, and you don't know what 500,000 of those actually are because you don't see them. Then it can be challenging. Digital immigrants. So I read this term actually in this Internet Security Alliance brochure. It was talking about how to talk to a CFO about cyber risk, and they had the notion of a digital immigrant. It was a person that that didn't grow up with, you know, with an Atari or with an internet connection or, you know, any kind of compute capability whatsoever. You know, they printed out things or had their admin do that and so forth, and they didn't really understand even, you know, even any network-based risk, much less dependencies that may exist somewhere else in the world, right? So they don't have a problem investing in a countermeasure or control or safeguard that, you know, might put out a fire suppression system or a backup power supply for something or, you know, physical security in a data center. But if you tell them they need redundant DNS servers or they need DDoS protection or they need, you know, spam mitigation capabilities or there are these threats somewhere else on the internet that they have to deal with, then they have a hard time investing in that. And so until these digital immigrants sort of realize that the risk associated with what they care about most, the assets, their online presence and availability, are entirely reliant upon the availability of all these supporting protocols and transactions, then it's going to be really challenging to get the proper investment in protecting those assets. Some spaghetti. So basically here, if you're not preparing for IPv6, you're already behind. It's within operational timeframes, and you definitely need to be looking at that. Within a year, it's, you know, the address space is going to be exhausted. The number certification resource repository, it's kind of interesting to think that on the internet today there exists no formally verifiable database that says who holds what IP addresses. We have integrity in DNS now, and DNS maps a name, a human-readable name to an IP address, but we don't have an authoritative database that says who holds what number resources. So absent that, you can't really rely upon that IP substrate entirely until you have that capability. So we definitely need resource certification, and some work's happening around that. DNSSEC landscape's challenging. It's kind of interesting if you think about DNSSEC. It brings integrity to DNS, but if you look at sort of the three pillars of information security, you have confidentiality, is it secret? You have availability, can I access it and with some reasonable performance? And you have integrity. And DNSSEC brings integrity to DNS, but it is more resource intensive, and it requires extra capacity and extra resource and state and CPU cycles and so forth. And so, you know, you're trading off availability to get integrity in the DNS. And so what does the integrity bring you? So if you looked at that spectrum earlier, it's like, what do I gain by having integrity in DNS? And the reality is that you gain the ability to connect with confidence to where you're going. So you have to secure the substrate first. What else do we want to say here? So compliance, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, I do a lot of security stuff, and you get compliance, and compliance usually trails reality by 5 to 10 years. And if you look at sort of the threat landscape, and most of what compliance aims at today, it's a couple things. It's like firewall that blocks everything but TCP port 80. It's antivirus software, and it's disk encryption, right? And if you look at threats today, it's like, well, all the threats and all the compromises are client-side infection, so they work right through a firewall and right through TCP port 80 and probably right through your web proxy. Your users get compromised. But you have a firewall there that maintains state, and it's a middle box in the network, and it compromises that end-to-end thing that we care a lot about. As a matter of fact, it usually becomes the bottleneck when there's a denial of service attack because it maintains state in the middle of the network, and it opens up those envelopes, and so it often fails in that case. Antivirus software, it's like you got to have AV. I mean, and AV actually does raise the bar, but you're not protected all the time with AV, right? Don't assume that because you have AV, you're not vulnerable. You need to make sure that you put other countermeasures or protections in place. And then disk encryption, it's useful, but most of the time, if somebody has access, if they've compromised your machine, then they probably have access to whatever it is, to the credentials you use to encrypt the disk anyway. So. What else do we have? So, you know, the Internet's at an inflection point. The Internet's really always at an inflection point, I guess. But there are a lot of new technologies that are, you know, they're sort of reshaping the Internet. And a lot of convergence. You see a lot of other protocols now. A lot of the traditional siloed networks like Frame Relay and ATM and voice and video and all those sorts of things are carried on IP networks now. When you carry those things, you converge those things on an IP network. They inherit the entire attack surface of every layer in that layered protocol model below them. So you have to emulate their essential attributes or whatever they required, but at the same time, they have this new attack surface that they're now captive to. And so you have to understand what enables that infrastructure below them. And if it's DNS or a routing update or an IP address, you better make sure that you have some security and adequate capability with that. All right, so end-to-end, you know, is challenged. A lot of people want to use things like, well, IPv4 and IPv6, because they're not bits on the wire compatible, there's capability for that to fragment or partition, you know, pieces of the Internet, and we definitely don't want that. The reason why the Internet's been successful is because of end-to-end, any-to-any connectivity. DNS is the same, right? If you use DNS as a policy enforcement function in a recursive name server, an authority zone, or on an end system, then you're going to fragment. You're not going to have a unique global namespace that resolves the same to all users. And that's challenging, right? That's basically fragmenting or partitioning the Internet. Multidisciplinary systemic approaches. One of the things I'm going to talk about this afternoon is a lot of people look at an attack surface. Even if you're looking at DNS attack surface and you see one or two elements, not all the elements involved with that. And, you know, and there are all these systemic elements that start all the way with the meat computer, right? The guy behind the keyboard that's, you know, that's inputting all the stuff. If he's in some way compromised or his credentials are compromised, it doesn't matter what other safeguards you might have in place. And then finally, you know, one of the things I had mentioned earlier is if, I don't know how many folks in here have heard about something like a CISSP, right? But it's basically a security certification you can get. And one of the things they teach you to do is, like, be pragmatic. When you go in an organization, talk about what the most critical asset to that organization is. And for most of the people in this room, it probably has something to do with network or availability or online presence or so forth. And so when you look at the valuation of that asset, you know, don't just think about investing in power supplies or circuit redundancy or fire suppression systems. Think about what enables that asset or that availability on the Internet. And it's probably got something to do with routing and DNS first and foremost, these infrastructure-enabling protocols. So you have to fully enumerate what enables that infrastructure, that asset that it is you're looking to protect, and then what countermeasures you might invest in to protect that asset. So. Anyway, with that, I know I probably moved fairly quickly, and you know my English. Well, I speak fast enough anyway, but you know I hope most of you actually speak some English. If you don't, then you might want to look at the slides, and you missed everything. But with any luck, you can at least go look at the slides, and this was remotely useful. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here today as well. So.
Thank you. It's nice of you to ask if we understand English at the end of the presentation. Nästa talare är Jonas Birgersson. Som ni vet har han hjärtat och passionen för bredband och internet. Han har varit mycket utomlands senaste tiden. Vill gärna dela med sig erfarenheterna.
Tack så mycket. Det var snällt att applådera, det var lite tveksamt, jag förstår det. Jag heter Jonas Birgersson och jag är som sagt ute och hasar runt i världen en hel del nu för tiden. Och jag tänkte berätta egentligen om ett par olika saker. Det är egentligen infrastruktur, hur vi ska kunna bygga den så att alla förstår. Och mina slides är på engelska, så att you have some chance at least to follow the slides. That's the, you know, the best thing you get. So I'm gonna give you a mirror or something. Okay. Fiber till alla, det är ju den här saken vi har pratat om. För att man ska kunna få det här bredbandet, att man bara slår på det som ström eller som ljus, då måste man få fiber till hemmet eller man måste få fiber till källaren där man bor i alla fall. Och det är alla ganska överens om. Och är man inte det, så kan man komma till vårt infrastrukturseminarium som är väl 13.40 i eftermiddag. Då kan man få till livs. Men fiber till alla, det är ganska överens om att det är det bästa sättet att få till bredband. Det är säkert, det är billigt och det är väldigt robust. Och sen har det obegränsad naturligtvis överföringskapacitet. Men här kommer då, varför ska vi hålla på med detta? Varför håller jag och andra envisa människor år efter år liksom, och tjatar öronen av er om det här? Jo, det är för att det här är världens bästa investering. Detta handlar inte om småpengar, utan detta handlar om, om man tittar på de största blocken vi har, det vill säga nationer, så är det så att investera i en digital infrastruktur, helst fiberbaserad förstås, det är den absolut bästa investeringen som ett land kan göra. Det är det man får bäst avkastning på. Och då finns det en tumregel som man har satt i sådana internationella sammanhang. Vi ska prata lite mer om vilka sammanhang det är och sådär. Men tumregeln är så här, att för varje 10% du ökar penetrationen med riktigt bredband, så ökar du BNP, bruttonationalprodukten, med 1%. Så har du 20% internetpenetration, vi kommer in, ser till att en nation bygger äkta bredband och vi får upp det till, säg, 50%. Det betyder att du får 3% extra BNP-tillväxt i det landet. Det finns ingen infrastruktursatsning som är i närheten av att ge den sortens avkastning. Och ni ser då, vad innebär att öka BNP med 3%, ja, det innebär att man dubblar välfärden på 24 år. Man dubblar levnadsstandarden i ett land på 24 år. Så hur i hela friden kan någon vara emot att man bygger den sortens infrastruktur? Jo, för att de flesta länder i världen styrs av familjer och de styrs av ett särintresse, och så har man en väldigt rik överklass och man har ganska lite intresse av hur det ser ut för hela landet. Men rent akademiskt så finns det inget bättre sätt att stödja ett land när det gäller dess ekonomiska utveckling än att bygga fiberbaserad infrastruktur. Det är därför jag och andra håller på med detta. Så min arbetsmiljö ser ut så där. Man sitter med en massa trevliga gubbar. Det är nästan bara gubbar, så att jag önskar att det inte vore det. Och sen har man den snorige svensken i sin tröja som är lätt att känna igen i alla fall. Och eftersom man jobbar utomlands i den här emerging market som det heter, så brukar jag säga att jag har den här tröjan för att jag är stolt över den och för att det ska vara lättare för folk att inte skjuta fel personer i panelen. För det är ganska många lokala intressen som man stör. Man ska tänka på att de här bolagen som utmanas av att man bygger den här äkta fiberbaserade infrastrukturen enligt en affärsmodell som ska jag berätta om senare. Det är alltså världens största bolag mätt på omsättning, de gamla telebolagen. De bolagen som tappade 90% av sin omsättning, om man tittar på tredje världen, när en kamrat då, naturligtvis Niklas Enström, införde Skype. Så det är stora pengar, det är stora krafter, men det måste göras. Och dessutom kan man ha lite kul, och det är ju synd om någon ska sätta kulan i pannan på fel kille. Liksom. Det vill man inte vara delaktig. Jag har hållit på med detta ganska länge. Det här är sådana här utlandsskryt, men jag började jobba med det här 93. Och det är lite roligt då. So for international guests, so in Sweden we were the world's first, we think, to do 10 megabit symmetric. We were the first to do triple play, and we did actually IPTV from the Sydney Olympics 2000. So just to give some background. We got a fair amount of attention for that. And the important thing, so it's okay, I mean, I'm not playing, it's good because I want to share it with our international friends. Is that okay? So they prefer me in English. At least some of them get some variations because they heard me before. But, you know, so I'll switch to English so that, you know, for your benefit. So basically we did this. We proved that you could build a new network. The B2, just, you know, very, very quick and short. But what we proved was that you could do a startup. That 2.5 people and a binder could challenge the entrenched telecom and say, we're going to build a new parallel network. And this actually worked out, and it worked out with a profit. So in 7 years, this startup went from zero, no brand, no nothing, to having 27% of all of the Swedish broadband. And this is very generous, also calculating technologies that I personally do not think is broadband, such as DSL and DOCSIS and this stuff. If you look on the 10 megabit symmetric, in these 7 years, there were more than 90% to this startup. So it is possible, as a startup, to build a new network and compete with the old infrastructure. And this has been proven. Of course, the Swedish broadband company did this in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Holland, and also as a facilitator in Italy. Why hasn't there been more people to follow up? Because broadband infrastructure is very, very challenging. It's a lot of, you know, invested interests, but not the nation's best interest. The nation's best interest is always to build a fiber optical network. Why is that? Well, this is just about, I got a few awards. This is just from my hometown in Lund. We had, you know, a few innovations, and we just want to share with you, because most of you are from Stockholm area, and we're very happy for the support of Sweden to get the ESS, the European Spallation Source. It's probably the first and only time in our lifetime that in a small village with 100,000 people, Europe will invest $2 billion. So thanks a lot for that. That would be good fun. And also, by the way, we have some other local thing that we built. So 25% of everybody living in Lund is one click away, 3 seconds, from getting a gigabit connection in their home. Of course, the connection is pre-wired, and then they have the portal, and they want to have a service. They click, 3 seconds later, they have the gigabit symmetrical. Of course, they get half a gig in Wi-Fi as a bonus, but that's just, you know, details. So welcome to Lund if you don't want to move. So I also do advisory work. So, you know, old pictures from political people and me as, you know, thinner. And you see the red boxes. What are the red boxes? These are, you know, some of my clients that have been a little more successful. So, of course, I'm part of the World Economic Forum, as you know. These are the people where they throw snowballs at us in, you know, Davos. Again, you have to have the right shirt so they don't kill the wrong guy. And here you can see the ranking. So this is actually, so on my list of clients that I've been doing advisory to, at, you know, they're on the top five at least, so there's something doing right. Probably it's all them. You know, it's just a coincidence that they work with me as well. So there is a lot of interest now for Sweden and the open network. What is that? Why? And also Google, of course, as you know, come along to do this. But let's explain what it is. So this is basically the revolutionary idea that was here in Stockholm in 99. And this was not invented by me. It was invented by three guys, all of them, Frederick, Frederick, and Frederick. And they are the real brains behind this open service exchange model. The only thing that I think is that they didn't realize the incredible global potential that they had. And they had a problem to make this operationally viable. So after a while, me and a few friends came along, the company was bought and transformed, and it's now been profitable for 3 years. But the key thing here is, how do you get this fiber to everybody? How do you pay for the deployment of fiber? Well, it's very easy. You have to combine two things that theoretically are outstanding. On the passive infrastructure layer, of course, it's much better to have a natural monopoly. Why? Monopoly sounds bad. Why? Natural monopolies is like airports. You don't want two airports very close. You don't want a parallel highway. What you want, if you have one building with a fiber into that building, and you have the means of investing into another building a fiber, should you put it into the building that already has a fiber, or should you put it into a building that does not have the fiber? Of course, you want to expand your network. If you can combine it with the top level, so this is the uniqueness. You have a natural monopoly, only one fiber going into the building, but in the open service exchange model, what we do, that we combine it with a completely open marketplace. Every single operator can sell all of their services on completely equal terms. So you have a full market dynamics on the top, and you have a full locked down, hard, natural monopoly on the infrastructure level. So theoretically, this is by no chance, there's nothing better. This is the best way if you can do it. The good thing is now in Sweden, we have more than 10 years of experience showing that this is really working. And this is what I think will be the model to build the fiber optical networks of the majority of connections in the world to come. So this is what I believe. And here is the tribute to Stockholm and Stokab. Stokab was one of the first companies in the world to get this. The municipality of Stockholm in 1994 decided to take the different fiber assets they had spread out in different companies around, so the water company, the electrical company, they took all of their fiber assets, they put it into one company, and this company, to run the natural local monopoly on fiber, has only one business model. It sells dark fiber to all of the connection that wants it. And then every single operator can use it on equal terms. And this has been a phenomenal success. So StoCub have had profit margins of over 30%. So if you're Google, that's not good. If you're Microsoft, this is not good. If you're into infrastructure, this is a world-class, insane Olympic record. Everything above 10% return on investment on passive infrastructure is unheard of. And we have this in Sweden. It has been around since 94. It has built a huge network, more than 5,500 kilometers of cables in a pretty small area. And it has led to Stockholm becoming one of the best ICT regions in the world. And this is a phenomenal example. And this is not unproblematic. In Copenhagen, you tried another model. You invested about the same amount of money, and basically they lost 80% of that money. And they know it because the Dong network was closed and sold, because they did not run it as a transparent network. They did not sell to everybody in equal terms. So this is a phenomenal global success. Okay. One detail. So this is in Stockholm, how you build a fiber optical network. You see on the right? This is last year from Amsterdam. This is just different. But if you're an infrastructure guy like me, if you're not doing that, you're going to have a lot of OPEX. And if you talk to the Dutch people, they say, no, 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 we also have a controlled environment. Look, the municipality is in the green and the commercial is in the blue. It's going to be, think 30 years, it's going to be a lot of, you know, fun things in Holland. The archaeologist is going to say, what happened here? Did they try to bury spaghetti? Is this an art project? Okay, so this was the theoretical model I talked about, but it's actually, it did happen. It has been running since 1999 in Stockholm. StoCab provided the fiber. Via Europa, Frederick, Frederick, and Frederick, they were setting up the Via Europa. They were running the active components. They were running the open service exchange, doing all of the things as an operator does, with the big exception of not selling any services to the households or to the corporations, but allowing all of the small service providers, to, or big, to come in on this neutral network and sell on equal terms to each and everybody, creating a marketplace on top where everybody can market exactly the same way. So the practical implication is that if you get a fiber to your building, if you get a fiber to your apartment, you're not locked in to one offering of services. Every single service provider that wants to come into the network will do so in an open, neutral, and non-competitive way. You understand? So you can click and choose, and people also have, Via Europa also has rules. For example, you cannot tie down a customer longer than 90 days, but because of competition, the average tie down in the contract is 30 days. And because the prices are pretty low, people have actually, you know, called customer care, and during the call, they went in the portal and said, hey, I'm not angry with you anymore. I'm not going to shout at you because I'm no longer a customer. So they change provider during the call because the only cost is an extra month, and that's like 20 euros. And if you're a little bit pissed, that feels really good. So some of the service providers have a unique thing that they have not told the public about. They're running two call centers, one call center for people in open networks and another one for traditional contracts with 18 to 24 months lock-in time. Which one would you rather call? Do you think that they treat you differently? They sure do. So this is also in Norway, just to give you an example. This is how it looks in Oslo, for an example. Of course, I'm biased. This is my clients, but you know, they run an open network. You can choose. You have lower price, high quality, stability, and it's all you deciding what mix of services you want. Okay. Same thing in Switzerland, so it's not only in Sweden. In Sweden, this is in Kristianstad. This is the most successful open service exchange network. They don't do basically anything themselves apart from the passive infrastructure. So the local electrical company, they run the passive. They, of course, they invest some in the active network, but they have, you know, a system integrator to run it for them. They have a commercial open service exchange operator on the outside to run everything. Of course, they still use their own local brand. And this is just another example. Tele2, you know, it's a very commercial operator, have decided in Norrköping, because of the real estate company's wishes, that they have opened up. So they are running these two levels. And then, of course, they sell their own services, but everybody else on equal terms, because they have a neutral layer in between. So if you put the demand to the market, it's really possible that a very, very traditional challenger, Tele2 these days, sorry if anybody's here, can really open up and still make a good business case. So it's a good model. Now, of course, this is some details, but just compare. So if you look on the people that does not have access to fiber in Sweden yet, so this is what you would be offered if you looked at Telia just a few weeks ago on their website. So 359, so you divide that by 10, then you get, you know, 36 euros for the 12 to 24, and then, of course, it's a 2.5 megabit the other way on the DSL. The best challenger, Tele2, they have, you know, very similar things, and it's, you know, 3 euros difference. But if you look on the open network like this instead, this was just from Lund in September, you could say that you got for 279, so for 28 euros, you got 100 megabit symmetrical, 10 megabit backhaul. Or you paid 37 euros and you got 100 megabit symmetric, just to compare. So basically the same amount of, so either it's 100 kroners cheaper, or for the same amount of money, you would be getting 100 megabit symmetric instead. And the red things here, because this was September, it's an important month, it was in Lund, it's an important month, students move in there, you were getting this for 5 months for free. And the 6th month, you pay this amount of money. This is what competition does. If you build a neutral network and you put the competition on top, this is what happens. Okay. And then you have unique things developing on this open service exchange network. So for an example, there's a setup in Sweden called Open Choice that you have one setup box, and with your remote control, you can basically choose between different TV packages. So I have this TV provider, I have this TV provider. Now, I want this instead, I can change, and I don't need to change the box. All of this is technically possible, it's just to find the right business models. Okay, and this gives better broadband business. And why is it important? It's important because we need to show that it's really a good idea to invest in building the new fiber optical networks that we then can run in a neutral fashion. Because remember that on average, an emerging markets country can get 3% extra gross national product just based on this. Okay, this is just details. So we're also very good in Sweden on doing services. Axis, you know, the camera system that watches over you when you go into the subway in Stockholm every morning. Of course, a Lund company. So you create this nice kind of services so that you can have in your home. In Sweden, we don't have a lot of crime, and Lund actually is the safest city, it's a village, the safest village in Sweden. And so how do you sell these cameras? Well, the thing is like this. All of the main Allmännyttan have built this into their garages because somebody scratched a car and you need to find who you should pay for the paint job. So even if we don't have crime, we have these kind of things. Also, a very popular application is that they use it and they watch what the dog is doing at home. Because when you're there, you're the boss. But what happens when you close the door? Well, you have the camera and you find out. Okay, so just to finish off, what I think is really, really good with Sweden, and then I'll tell something that are not so good in Sweden. Maybe I'll do that in Swedish. So in Sweden, we have created, you know, insane amount of fascinating services. Niklas Zennström and Skype. Skype is one of the best global services ever. Developed, of course, you know, primarily in Sweden, a Swedish guy and a Danish guy, plus a development team in the Baltic States. But it has been one of the biggest game changers anywhere. You know, they're getting close to 400 million users. They have changed the telecom industry forever. It's the biggest carrier in the world if you look at international phone calls. And these phone calls, of course, are for free. Sorry. And it came out of a piracy. You remember Kazaa? The Kazaa network, you could download and share music for free. And then that evolved to Skype. So it's really interesting to see how Sweden can develop this kind of global services. We're only 9 million people. We shouldn't be able to do anything. And then you have these people, Peter Sunde, as the spokesman for Pirate Bay. We can think whatever we like about the Pirate Bay, but it's a global phenomenon. Again, Sweden puts a list on one of the, you know, biggest sites in the world, and they do it basically as some kind of a dorm project. It's not very serious, they, you know, doing these kind of things, and they have suddenly a huge service. And the same thing I see again, it will evolve. What happens now, of course, is that we see one of them, Peter Sunde, running this very interesting called Flatter. I think that Flatter could become and should become bigger than Skype. What Flatter enables, which comes very back to the first presentation, it allows people to share money with online content. Not because they have to, but because they want to. It has really interesting growth. Because when you can pay directly to the artist, when you can pay directly to the blogger, and you can pay in the film or in the music, once you like it, you just click. And the amount of money that you have volunteered to put into your account every month, if you click 10 times, that money, let's say 10 kroners, will be divided, and there will be money sent to each created person. So this is a really interesting development. But just it just goes on this list. Anybody heard about Minecraft? Of course you have. Minecraft is the digital version of Lego, the Lego system. You can go into your virtual world, and you can build anything. And it's really, really cool. And the one person that built this as a hobby project, it's still, I think it's if it's a pre-alpha or it's pre-beta, whatever it is, you can download it. And last month, he made $2 million because of people wanting to pay for his content. He has a free service. But people wanting to buy the game, he last month got $2 million. He's not a big brand. He's not no brand. He just did this tool that was insanely great, and it put on the web. And in Sweden, we do these new services over and over and over and over again. Of course, we got Spotify, but in my book, without Pirate Bay, without shaking the old media tree, you would not have Spotify. So Sweden is really, you know, in an impossible way, taking at least sometimes center stage, creating new services. And we're really good at it, but I have a big problem. I want to take this power and this entrepreneurship, and I want to focus it also into using it into big Swedish organizations. I want it in the healthcare system, I want it in the educational system, because in the same way that we're really insanely good at doing small teams that do global services and compete with everybody and win without venture capital, without the smartness of Silicon Valley, we are not good at using this stuff in the big organizations in Sweden. We're taking a lame approach. We're going the safe, boring road. It's like, now we're deploying a lot of PCs to schools everywhere in Sweden. That's fantastic. And then we do innovative stuff like using Microsoft and Apple. It's like, yeah, that's very, let's say, innovative. I mean, could there be any alternative to running an AD server? Well, you could do like freeware, yeah, but that's like complicated, yeah, for you maybe, but you know, yeah, but the students, they don't want it. Well, I'm not so sure. They're here to learn. So I think that we need to step up and take some challenges into, let's say, the everyday life and be inspired by these phenomenal entrepreneurs that are doing a great job because we have the infrastructure. Most people around the world, they don't have the infrastructure. They dream about the infrastructure that we have, and then we don't use it in all aspects of society. So that, I think that's a big letdown. And I'll tell you just a few minutes about a few really embarrassing examples. So I'll switch to Swedish. So, vad som inte är så bra i Sverige. Här har vi skandal. Jag jobbar just nu i 15 länder. De flesta av dem är utvecklingsländer. I utvecklingsländer förväntar man sig familjer, dynastier, korruption och skandaler. Den skiten har vi här hemma också. Och det tycker jag vi ska ta och radera ut fort som tusan. För det har jag sett flera gånger mycket nära med egna ögon. Hur otroligt förstörande det är för förtroendet i ett land när man inte har rensat på mattan. Så bara ta några snabba enkla grejer här. Vi har ingen politisk ledning. Vi har en flat maktstruktur som kan jaga enstaka fildelare. Men när man gör den här sortens brottslig verksamhet som handlar om miljardbelopp och dessutom en massa möjligheter som krossas, då är vi otroligt flata. Och det tycker jag vi ska sluta med. Okej, här står jag och säger en massa dumma grejer. Låt mig ge två exempel bara på varje. Teracom, att bygga ett markbundet digitalt tv-nät för 5 miljarder för att man ska kunna sända tv åt ett håll. Det är inte så där jättesmart. Det är dock lagligt, för det var den diskussion som jag hade med riksdagen och lite olika människor hade sagt att vi får ta hur dumma beslut vi vill, bara de är rätt underbyggda liksom. Så det är ju ett fint försvar tycker jag. Men jag tycker vi kanske skulle kunna se om vi skulle höja ribban lite. Vi kanske till och med skulle kunna ta bra beslut. Men mina favoriter på Terracom, de fortsatte, de gav sig inte. Utan de byggde upp en öppen kommunikationsoperatörsverksamhet. Det fanns redan ett antal privata bolag som gjorde det. 100% statligt ägt bolag säger, vi ska bli kommunikationsoperatör. Varför det? Men gjorde de det. Sen kom de på efter ett tag, efter rekryterat ett personal från mig, att vi klarar inte av det här. Så då sålde de en balanspost på över 1 miljard för 1 krona till ett bolag där styrelseordföranden var delägare. Till ett bolag där konsulten som skötte den här processen var delägare. Och så visade det sig häromdagen att de fick dessutom med 47 miljoner. Och när regeringens representant i styrelsen blev pressad om det här så sa han, nej men, för att man undrade, ska man verkligen använda statliga pengar så här? Då sa han, nej men, det mesta av det var kommunala pengar. Så om ni är någon journalist här, så Telia, Fandenkvast eller vad han heter, jag vet inte riktigt vad han heter. Vi hade någon kul åklagare som var på hugget om det här med korruption och mutor. Telia hade väl köpt någon balbiljett eller hur? De har köpt någon biljett till Operan eller någonting som kostade någon 50-lapp mer än vad man fick ge bort. Och då var det liksom mutskandal eller sånt där. Det där, varför inte det anmält? Varför skrivs det inte om det? Varför är det inte anmält? Ta Telia. Telia åkte ju dit. De blev fällda i EU för prisdumpning när det gällde bredband. I början med bredbandsbolaget. EU fällde dem. Så nej, ni har gjort dominerande aktörer för att göra på det här stygga sättet. Sen var det lugnt och fint i 10 år. Men nu är Telia på gång igen. Vi såg det officiella priset på 370 kronor eller vad det var. För DSL. När de går in och tar affär idag på fiber. Då får du internet. Du får tv. Och du får telefoni för 200 kronor i månaden. Jag som en 200 kronor i månaden kramar tycker det är trevligt. Men det funkar inte om Telia får dumpa in sig på marknaden på det sättet. Och det kan bli dyrt om någon skulle anmäla Telia för det där igen som vi gjorde med bredbandsbolaget. För straffet är upp till 10% av omsättningen. Och då undrar man, hur tar våra politiker de här besluten? Vet man om de här riskerna av det man gör? Och sen det sista då, det är att vi har de här kommunala stadsnäten som oftast gör ett ganska bra jobb. Och sen har vi några exempel som är fruktansvärda. Man pratar om rogue states. Här har vi liksom kommunaltjänstemän som har blivit talibaner. Och det måste vi också styra upp. Vi har ju, uppe i Norrland har vi exempel där man då säger att man har upphandlat det här på marknaden för 0 kronor av en tjänsteleverantör och säger därför så behöver vi kan stoppa in det i hyran och vi konkurrerar inte med näringslivet. Vi har alltså ett offentligt ägt bolag som ger bort tjänster som produceras av privata näringslivet och det finns många sådana exempel. Men jag tycker bara att vi inte är värdiga det. Vi är så duktiga på så mycket annat. Så att slippa få den här korruptionen som man kan se utomlands på många olika ställen. Vi vill inte ha det i Sverige. Jag tror att tillsammans så kan vi bara sudda ut den sista sliden. Och sen så ska vi vara stolta över vår tjänsteproduktion. Och få in lite mer av den här Minecraft-känslan. Eller liksom Flutter-känslan. Eller Skype-känslan. In i våra offentliga organisationer. Lite mer jävlar anamma. Och så ett par anmälningar och ett par fällningar. Så blir detta jättebra. Tack så mycket.
Tack, tack. Presentationen var sponsrad av Lund. Vi har gått över tid lite grann. Så just nu håller vi på att äta oss in i kafferasten. Men om det finns någon som har en väldigt spännande fråga så får ni jättegärna ställa den. Då blir det kaffe. Tack. Thank you, Jeff, Danny and Jonas.